The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/undisclosed. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
D. Watkins here with Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today, I'll be joined by my wonderful co-host, Marsha Chatwin. Marsha is our host. She's also Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University. She's a scholar of African American life and culture, as well as a national speaker on social movements, past and present, including Black Lives Matter. Also, the great Adam Jackson. So happy to have him here today. I know, you know, our listeners, they're going to love him. Or hate him, but either way, he's going to be bringing the truth. You know, he's telling the truth. He's a chief executive officer of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We're going to definitely talk about more on how we can support them and their movement, as they have the best reputation for putting in work with young people, and you know, our city needs them. He's a CEO. Mr. Jackson is responsible for management and oversight of the daily operations of the organization and the execution of its mission to advance public policy interests of Black people in Baltimore through youth leadership, development, political advocacy, and autonomous intellectual innovation. And we also have a new friend, Scott Goldman. My first time meeting Scott, seems like a really great guy. He's an executive director of the Sixth Branch, a veteran-led community service organization that brings together veterans and civilians to serve our community on the home front in East Baltimore, my home. Scott is a graduate of Harvard College and Vanderbilt University School of Law, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Vanderbilt Law Review. Thank you guys for joining us. Marsha.
So this week's episode focuses on the narrative that there were six stops between the moment that Freddie was arrested and when he eventually ended up at Central Booking. And so this episode was really challenging for us to write because there were so many details and so many different sources of data about what happened, but it still had some real challenges in creating a coherent picture of what happened that day. And so I think in this episode, listeners can really learn about three very important issues. One, the protocols of what happens when a person is arrested in Baltimore and what are the responsibilities for when they're put into police vehicles. I talk about seatbelting, what the protocols are if someone is in distress and has an injury and reports needing help, as well as the constant presence of closed-circuit televisions, which we'll talk about in depth in future episodes, about why the city of Baltimore has so many cameras and what's the effectiveness of these cameras if they can't capture what really happens, right? They have such a limited scope. And then the last part is a narrative about rough rides. And I think that for us, it was really important to talk about why so many people defaulted to a rough ride narrative and why that came up at trial because of a long history of rough rides being used to discipline and to harm people after they're arrested. And so I think for folks who are not so familiar with these different forms of police abuse and police mismanagement, this is really an education on all of the places and all of the steps where things can go terribly wrong.
So one thing, the tone of the police officers in the episode, just how they came across, you know, because it's like the way they made their statements, the way some of them interviewed, their body language, even how they appeared in court was, it's totally fine to just drag or, you know, to hurt or to disrespect the Black person as if they don't work for them. I think sometimes these police officers forget that you work for citizens. You're not there to dictate. You're there to do a job. I definitely want to talk to you about that and to get some perspective on that aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the fundamental problems with the Baltimore City Police Department and just policing in general around the country is that there's a fundamental lack of respect for black life, and a fundamental lack of humanity that they see in us. Like, they don't see black people as human beings. They see us as cattle to be herded, people to be smacked around, dragged around. So when I heard about Freddie Gray dying, to me, you know, it was messed up, because back then I didn't really expect people to be as mad about it, you know, because like black people die in Baltimore from police brutality, like, you know, it's like it's raining outside. And so, especially when you hear about cases like Tyrone West and other black people who've been killed by police. And so I think it's just a fundamental lack of respect they have for the humanity of black people. And the reason that's the case is because there are laws and legislation and policy in place to ensure that they don't have to be held accountable when people die as a result of their actions. And so ultimately the question is, how do we change the institutional arrangement and the structural inequalities that make it so that black people are treated this way? And I think that that's what the police unions and the police department, like, they don't want us to talk about that. They much rather talk about, you know, stuff like, let's have more community relations meetings.
A day of service.
Yeah. Let's play football games. Let's interact with each other in all these like superficial ways, when it's like the structural nature of your police department is racist, and we need to solve that. And no one in the police department wants to fix that problem. They just want to, you know, have the PR and all that stuff associated with it. But ultimately, how do we change those institutional arrangements instead of like these superficial qualities of policing?
Yeah, because right now, as it stands, we know the outcomes of the case.
Right.
So that was a big win for the system.
Yeah.
You know, so Scott, you were a veteran, and, you know, we had a loose conversation before you came in about how some of the things that you saw in Afghanistan mirrored in this city. You care to speak to that?
Yeah, sure. I spent a year in Afghanistan, in southeast Afghanistan, working with the Afghan judicial legal system. I'm an attorney myself, so I was working with prosecutors and law enforcement. One day stands out. We were visiting sort of the local jail. And we walk in, and there's 9 old men just lined up waiting in the sort of the hallway. And we asked them what happened. And basically there was some sort of dispute between two groups, two big families, turned into a real fight. And the police came out and looked at everyone, and they just arrested everyone they could find. And the 9 old men were the ones who just couldn't run away as fast as everyone else. And this was policing in this one province. It was zero tolerance policing, where if anything happens, you arrest everyone on site, you bring them in, you ask questions later. I think about that all the time when I think about zero tolerance policing and the legacy and the problems that's led here. I mean, besides that, where I work today, I direct a veterans nonprofit. We do community redevelopment and community service work here in East Baltimore.
So you see that in Afghanistan, and you come to work in East Baltimore, you see something similar. What does that make you think of the system in general?
It's depressing. It's depressing. You spend all your time trying to improve things around the world, and there's things right here that you have to do the same work. I mean, I walk around, we build parks and playgrounds, and there's one park that I'm thinking of here where it's basically surrounded by vacant houses. I remember walking through one of them, and, you know, there's a tree growing up in the middle of it, and the ruins of that were as bad as anything I'd seen overseas.
I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind, is the way that we are now in a moment where there's this like reciprocal relationship between military activity overseas and policing in the United States. And I think that one of the many ways in which people became better educated citizens in 2014 after Ferguson is when people started to ask, where does the Ferguson Police Department, where does St. Louis County get all of this military equipment from, right? And it started to expose the ways that we have a continued militarization of local police departments, but without the requisite training to really understand the impact of using things like tanks and chemical weapons on populations in the United States. And so I think it's really interesting the way that a lot of our overseas work was about training police forces so that there can be local autonomy in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. But the ways that we are also perhaps importing a system or perhaps developing these strategies that are about zero tolerance, are about a kind of creating constant surveillance of people in their own communities that we start to see. And so what happens as a result of that is movements like the movements for Black Lives has so much solidarity overseas in places that probably can't imagine Baltimore, and, you know, places where folks in Baltimore, maybe they can't imagine, but they're tied in this global struggle around, you know, excessive policing and excessive police force.
I'm from the Annie Jones era, when homicides was high. Every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West side be getting money, but it's different on my side.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports Undisclosed. My husband and I recently bought a new home, so I can tell you this from experience. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. You don't have to waste your time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information online to get a personal approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. So whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank. Skip the waiting. And go completely online at quickenloans.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
I think when we think about these different systems, I struggle with this because I feel like it goes deeper than policy. You know, police officers or people who subscribe to that culture, who join the force, they're trained and they're already indoctrinated in the idea of, you know, that there's just something innately wrong with Black people. they believe it. Like, they believe it. So it's like, how do you start? And I know, you know, we have to fight these wars on multiple fronts. So, you know, you need people on policy. You need people on the street. You need people, right, you know, in the classroom. But it's like these people think that there's something wrong with Black people, and they wear that and they believe that and they inhale and they snort that and they fill themselves up with it every time they put their little Nike boots on and jump in a squad car.
You could apply the same thing to, you know, the U.S. military, because I don't believe that everyone who joins the U.S. military is an evil, crazy person who just wants to kill people.
Well, some people want college money.
That, yeah, right. Some people want to pay for their college education. And so, but, you know, I think that it's like you just said, you know, fundamentally speaking, it's ingrained in you. Like, anti-Blackness and racism is within the training of law enforcement in the U.S. military. So, like, kind of how in Baltimore, you know, because my parents actually were both in law enforcement for 30 years apiece. And so, you know, they were in corrections, you know, in a local agency here in Baltimore. And so one of the things that, you know, both my parents are Black, and I don't believe that they hate Black people, but you could tell that part of how they see, have to see Black people to be effective, quote unquote, at policing in Baltimore or at law enforcement period, is that you have to put Black people in this box. Like, we are, you know, we are savages. And not to say that that's what they think, but that's how they have to approach it in order for their, you know, policing strategies or whatever they have to do within their agencies to work. And I think it's pretty interesting because, like, white folks, particularly folks that work in these different types of, you know, law enforcement agencies or what have you, believe that they themselves are, like, not the racist, when it's like, that's not really the issue. The issue is the culture and the environment, the structure and the institutions that promulgate all these issues within law enforcement and militarization. And so that's how you get at it, because, you know, you can't just talk about it from a policy point of view, but there are all these structural elements in place that we have to be attacking at the same time in order to deconstruct the ways that policing affects us.
I think part of the problem is a migration of an occupation mentality from the military to our civilian culture and into policing too.
Like, a lot of cops are ex-military, and they come with the same mentality?
Yeah, some of it is probably actual people, but I think
work in infantry though? Like, so no, like no medic?
No. But I don't think you even need the people. I think it's a culture, and it's an institutional transition. I think and it goes back, I mean, I think since 9/11 too, we've had a national effort to add a level of sort of military readiness and responsiveness to our policing on a domestic level, which looks a lot and feels a lot, and you start to use the same language and the same tactics.
Oh, yeah.
Feels a lot like military.
So how do you change a culture? Like, try to tell one of these evangelicals that you don't feel like going to church. Do you know how impossible that is? Like, tell that Jehovah's Witness in the parking lot at Mont Dorman that you don't want the final call. You just don't want. Like, I'm not against it. I'm not going to, you know, write an essay attacking it. I just don't, you know, I got the heavy reading list. I don't want that. Like, how do you do that?
I think that's very funny. But I think that, I think that one of the things that, we're pointing to is that when you have an entire kind of nation built on anti-blackness, and then you have a culture in which anti-blackness is reinforced, I think sometimes we underestimate kind of what it takes to resist it. And so I think that, what we can do with the culture, I think exposing it is so vital, because I'm always floored by the number of people who actually don't know this, who actually cannot imagine a world in which there's this much malfeasance. And so I like to think that what we're doing here is getting one step closer to a vision of freedom, because people become fully aware of what this looks like, not in a kind of theoretical sense, not in the, well, maybe one person did something bad one time, but to look at the way how pervasive it is. I don't understand how anyone could listen to a few of these episodes where people are talking about hearing Freddie Gray screams. In this episode where we talk about the seat belting issue and, everyone thinking, well, Freddie was just exaggerating that he was hurt. That kind of indifference to human life, the indifference to Black life, that's why we have to talk about it as much as possible, because I think that there are systems that allow people to be completely ignorant of just how much suffering we have in our culture. And so I'm always amazed by the power of actually just telling the story and being very clear about it as one step closer to this thing that we want to see.
Yeah, I want to connect this, but just to, to touch on that really quickly, it's like, who are you to say that his screams yeah. not good enough? Yeah. The tone was just like, oh, he just didn't want to go to jail. Nobody wants to go to jail. But anybody knows, you're going anyway. It don't make that many people have been to the hospital and then taken to jail. Like, it's like, it's instant cash. It's not a thing, but it connects, because it's going back to something Adam said. And something I think we should revisit is just the mentality of a police officer. This is how this conversation connects, because another problem I think we have, Marsha, is the people who we feel like, or who we are calling, or who we think is racist, don't think they're racist. They don't think they're racist. I loved Magic Johnson as a kid. I'm not racist. I fucking just listened to Prince. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't think they're racist, but they're actually, everything they do is racist, but they might be friends with a Black person. Everything they do is racist, but they might Ray Lewis dance down to a T. You know what I mean? But even if you go back to like Ray Lewis, who met with Donald Trump, Ray Lewis has said things that mirrored white supremacy. He's big and Black, but he said things that came directly from the playbook of the oppressor.
Yeah. And again, it's not about, because I think, again, when people talk about police officers, we have this vision in our head of like this virulent, racist white man who's coming to police our neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And instead, that's why it's a cultural issue in our society, because there are Black officers who, in many ways, like you just described, can propagate white supremacy just merely because of the way the system is designed.
Better than Black history quotes.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And the thing is, in Maryland in particular, because this is why the structural things are so important. In 1974, when Maryland passed the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights in the Maryland General Assembly, that state law protected Maryland law enforcement officials from any accountability, and that many police unions around the state, they tout this law as one of the most effective laws at protecting police. And I think Maryland's is probably the most strict version of its law. Like, there are 13 states, I believe, that have a version of a Bill of Rights for police officers, and Maryland has like the best, according to the National Fraternal Order of Police. And ultimately, it's like, well, what is that kind of policy or legislative position say about what we think about police? It means that we automatically are elevating where police are in society versus where we see Black people. Like, the Freddie Gray screams don't matter in a world where we have entire laws protecting police when they kill people like Freddie. And so how do we change those structural arrangements? Because I think we can make it abstract. We could talk about, how the system is designed, but there are very specific instances and locally where we can change how these dynamics work. I think sometimes, though, the problem with us, particularly advocates, because we can have real pie in the sky ideas. But I think ultimately you got to bring it down to the local level in a place like Baltimore or around a state like Maryland. Like, how do we make the actual changes necessary, whether it's policy, education, or what have you? We have to figure out how to change the structural arrangements locally where we're at. But, I think
exactly. And the first step is acknowledging the flaws.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But even beyond that, and both of you guys do work, so this is, I would also like to give you an opportunity to talk about some of the things that you've done that actually work. I feel like too often I'm at events and functions and panels and, you know, people just, you know, everybody has the stats memorized.
Yeah.
Like everybody
yeah.
has like an instant, okay, I'm going to do a panel about some of these black issues. Let me just go to the memorization stat. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
87 million incarcerated, 87% below the rating line, 87% got beat up. By, you know, everybody knows the stats, but what can we actually do? And I think our mm-hmm. listeners want to know what they can actually do or how they can support people that are actually doing things.
So my organization is a grassroots think tank. And so one of the things that we particularly focus on in Baltimore is legislative changes that need to be made, not just here in Baltimore, but around the state. So that way we can, you know, uplift and transform the material conditions of black people. I have a few funny stories about what's happened this year, because a lot of people know about the story of Kalief Browder and bail, when bail reform around the country needs to happen. Because Kalief Browder, he was incarcerated for a crime he didn't commit. The only reason he didn't get out is because he couldn't play bail. And so this year we've been doing a bunch of advocacy around bail reform. And so to your point, D, about what's been effective, you know, this year, you know, the bail industry, it's a multi-million dollar industry. And so they've been like paying off legislators left and right. They took them out to Ruth Chris like on two different occasions. They threw all these lavish dinners for them and have been doing all this advocacy in Annapolis away from Baltimore to our local legislators. And so one thing I found to be effective in terms of the work we're doing, we've had to call them out consistently, like all the black legislators who aren't supporting this, because
they like their stakes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And they brought the thing that tripped me out the most, for real, was that they brought the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Baltimore Urban League, the National Action Network, the state NACP. They brought them all to Annapolis to advocate for the bail industry here in Maryland. And they didn't know why that was insane when you talk to them directly.
Because they don't know people.
And, right. And it's so racist. It's so racist. Like, you know, a white person's in charge. It's so racist to think that you could bring all these old civil rights organizations that no one listens to and then sit them in front of some legislators like, yeah, all these black people say we're good. Oh. It's like,
I'm offended as a citizen, but I'm also offended as a historian. Do they know what bail was back in the day? I mean, I think that's so perfect.
Right. It was wild to me. It was wild to me. Because you had to see, like, one by one. They were like, and matter of fact, the dude that leads the SCLC, an organization that's not a thing now, but, like, he got up and was like, yeah, Dr. King wants us to have what the bail industry is offering.
Did you text him? Like, did he text Dr. King?
I'm slowly dying inside hearing this story.
Because you know Trump met with Dr. King over in Black History Month. That's what he said. That's what Sean Spicer said.
Right.
Donald Trump is not a racist. He had dinner with Dr. Martin Luther the King Jr.
Frederick Douglass, someone you hear about more and more.
I've heard about him. I'm glad he's starting to pop up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There.
But yeah, that's just one example of things that we've been doing this year. But overall, tactics that we've used to try to be effective is that there's just local laws and policies that are in place. And so we try to recruit local residents to get involved in their community. And so that's an element of it, is policy, law, and being in front of legislators. Because half the battle, especially on the state level, like, it's just being present. Like, being present in front of legislators and letting them know what your agenda is. I think too often we get paid off and bought off and pacified. And so with that bail issue, it was like they expected us to leave because of all the millions of dollars that were involved. But we've pissed them off pretty heavily because we've been down there every, you know, basically every day. And so we're at the last, like, week and a half of getting it done. So, yeah.
Solutions.
Yeah. So the sixth branch, we work in three East Baltimore communities, Oliver, Darley Park, and Johnston Square. I think we focus on the problems by focusing on space. We work with community associations to meet their needs and goals for vacant spaces, vacant lots in their communities. And, you know, that's a range of things. We're working on about 11 acres right now, building parks and playgrounds, maintaining city parks. We run a community farm in Oliver. And, you know, the context we work in every day is decades of redlining, of choices the city has made about not putting transportation in the places where it's needed, and about all the racial divisions throughout the city. I mean, I live on the 700 block of South Montford, that's in Canton. 700 block of North Montford is a completely different world, and that's 14 blocks. That's one letter, S or N. And that's the difference in Baltimore. East Baltimore versus Southeast Baltimore, or one neighborhood versus another. What we do is we are very practical. We're a veteran-led organization. We have that spirit still. And we go out there every day, and we grab a shovel, and we...
When a cop see you in a neighborhood, then it's like a good thing. Do they feel like they can interact with residents more, or do they feel like?
When the cops see us in the neighborhood, they usually stop and ask, you realize where you are. You know what you're...
Well, they probably think you're trying to buy drugs.
No, well, or they think we're crazy or something.
You looking for dope?
Yeah. No, we usually get...
So you're looking for dope. No, they have that on the other side of Montford. No, we can... You know,
yeah. Yeah, we've had a lot of funny interactions. We usually get... It's usually surprise when if the police see us.
Surprise? And why? You see a problem. Mm-hmm. You try to solve it. And they're surprised that you would try to solve it. Why is that? When their whole job is based on problem solving, why are they surprised?
I mean, the park we're building in Darley Park is on a series of lots that hasn't been touched in 30 years. And it's funny because there's a place a lot of vehicles would park and, you know, there's construction vehicles. DPW left this giant crane there forever. Police cars would sort of sit up there waiting to then go out and deploy places. I think sometimes these problems persist, and you see it physically in vacant lots and in vacant spaces when they fill with trash and when people sort of lose hope in them. You can see it physically. The problems persist so long that no one thinks there's a solution. And sometimes if you try to approach it too broadly, it's impossible to find a solution. That's why we focus very specifically, mm-hmm. very tangibly. What can we actually build right here? What can we do to make this space better? And how can we do that with the communities? And that's something I'll emphasize. It's very easy. There are a lot of well-intentioned outsiders who come into neighborhoods and want to help and want to do things right. You have to, though, talk first and ask people what they actually want and follow that lead. And we don't do anything unless it's the community association leaders or the neighborhood leaders give us direction on where to go and work with us.
That's the only way to work.
Marsha, could you speak from the perspective of SNCC or the SCLU?
Or the SCLC. Oh, man. You knew that bail thing really got me.
Okay. I got stories on stories about it.
So here's the thing. You know, I teach a lot of classes about the civil rights movement, and I try to, you know, have some takeaways for my students. The first is local people, that there are no movements without local people. And I think that I try to really decenter this idea that, you know, it's just the strong leaders who can give speeches, who are, you know, moving people to action. Actually, today, after I get off this phone call, I'm going to teach about, you know, the Black women who were in the trenches of the civil rights movement, defending themselves against sexual assault, building their communities, who we don't hear about. And the point is that it's local people who are the fiercest protector of their neighborhoods and their family and the people that they love. So that if we're going to have any change, it's local people like we were talking about who are going to do this. I think what happens sometimes with these national civil rights organizations, they have this really storied past, and as they continue to grow or try to keep their influence, you start to see them colluding with forces that are not the most positive for local people on the ground. And so this is where you start to get these huge infusions of capital from certain corporations or support of things like the crime bill back in the 90s. You start to see these ways that power is negotiated. And that's the kind of thing that we're going to be talking about on the podcast later on, because one of the big questions about how does this happen in a Black-run city, you know, we've talked about this before, Dee, it actually doesn't matter. You know, there's systems in place that actually make sure that a Black-run city can have this type of malfeasance. And when we look at the officers in the case, it is a multiracial group of people who are responsible for Freddie's death. And it is a place where you see the influence of organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League, but we can't always assume that these organizations are always working in the best interest of local people. And that's why I think it's so important for people to support groups like the Sixth Branch and Beautiful Struggle and all of these organizations that may seem small in scale comparatively, but it's their proximity that makes them so powerful because they're actually responding to people's needs. And they also have the capacity to make sure that people are covering these issues on multiple fronts. So, you know, while you're building a park, someone's in Annapolis making sure that this bail nonsense doesn't come through, and then someone else is keeping an eye on, you know, the local mayoral races, and other folks are keeping an eye out on kids. Like, it takes all of these things working together, and I think that the most effective way to do it is localized leadership.
And to your point, actually, I think that point about following local leadership is essential, because I think that sometimes you can discount the effectiveness and the necessity of local leadership, because in 2015, when the uprising happened, I'll never forget it. It was a bunch of national organizations that came, you know, to Baltimore, and they were actually all in my office at one point. I mean, Davon told me, they were like, yeah, like such and such was in your office and such was here. I was like, who are these people? And I knew their names kind of by abstraction, like, oh yeah, I've seen them on CNN, I've heard about them on Twitter or whatever. And so when they all came here, you know, I'll never forget, we were sitting around talking about the next move, and like all these national folks had a particular vision for what they thought that was supposed to be. They were like, yeah, we need to go write a letter to the mayor, that we need to go do this and that. And so we had stopped the whole thing, and we were like, we already know what we're doing. You just need to stop and you need to follow instead of trying to lead. And most of the time, I think that fundamental idea that black people in community need to be the ones leading the fights in their communities, I think that sometimes that's a foreign idea. And it's only foreign when it's black people. You know what I mean? Like, we don't ask Korean merchants to back down if there's an ordinance affecting, you know, their liquor licenses in Baltimore. Like, the Korean Merchants Association, they step up, and it's very clear it's for Korean merchants. They step up and make sure they go to city council. They lobby for themselves. And no one questions that. But with black people, though, it's like, oh, why you got to speak up for yourself? Why you got to lead? Why can't the white folks who have all the money and all the power and all the access be the ones leading? Or why can't the black people who aren't from here, you know, lead the fight for justice? And I think that's one big difference in Baltimore with BLM. Because there is no BLM Baltimore. And that's why I think we're not really on the news like that on the national level anymore, is because we kicked out a lot of those national people, and people are salty about it, because it's like, we already had an infrastructure for black people and doing black liberation work. And so how do you follow the grassroots leadership instead of just trying to come into Baltimore for an agenda that doesn't advance our condition here in Baltimore?
And like, why are you on tour? Shouldn't you like... Yeah. Stick to like, you know, right. Like, why are you on tour? Like, there's like one, if one community is damaged, you should probably put all of your energy into fixing that community.
Exactly.
You can't just jump from state to state to state to state to state.
Right.
Like, it doesn't really work
right,
like that.
Right.
The gritty, dirty work is never highlighted. I think it's the important work. I think the talking point people are the ones who benefit from these things. And, I think it also represents a history of why a lot of movements are failed. Because you got to get off tour, and you got to get in the mix and fight these issues on multiple levels.
That's a good point. I mean, putting it like as a tour, that's what it felt like.
It is a tour. That's why, you know, it's like, so I do everything strategic, like relationships, work, who I give my time, my energy, my money to, everything strategic. So it's like, I see it though. Like, I can see it from like a month away. It's, you know, are you going to use that energy to combat that? Because it turns into multiple wars. You got to fight these races. Then you got to fight these clowns.
Hey,
you know what I'm saying?
Hey,
and then you got to fight the people in the community who, you know, who you want to love themselves the way they should. It's just a new fight. It's all of these different fights. And I think, I'm glad you highlighted that. You know, most of the people who get the opportunity to be mouthpieces of these movements aren't really a part of any movement outside of their own.
And I feel like people call it, think it's mean. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, because it's like what it feels like is, or aren't I important as well? And it's like, no, you are not. You are not as important as this issue. And like, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm a fascist or something. But like the whole fundamental concept of like, I matter and my opinion matters just doesn't translate well to me. Because it's like, if everyone's opinion matters, it's like that it means we're listening to everyone's opinion about what we all should be doing. It's like, no, we should have the most effective strategy for liberation, period. And I don't know why sometimes people get so caught up in, well, I matter as well. Me too, my opinion. It's like, it doesn't matter. And I think in Baltimore, you know, we don't have time for that. Like, Baltimore is a city that's on the brink. Like, I think we're like 5 years out from like actual gentrification. Like, real life, like D.C., how it is
no,
now.
No, I walked down 8th Street in D.C. yesterday with a guy who does a lot of community work there named Tony Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And 8th Street was off the hook back, like, in like, I'm talking like 7 years ago. 7 years ago, you wasn't gonna get caught on 8th Street.
Now they
have a Whole Foods, they have Lofts, they have like a Belport with like this Ryan Reynolds type dude, like,
over
here. Like, you know, it wasn't actually Ryan Reynolds, but it was a dude that looked just like Ryan Reynolds. Like, yo, you can live in a neighborhood with people that look like Ryan Reynolds on 8th Street, a shoe city across the street from a Whole Foods. I swear to God,
get out of here.
Which one is gonna be gone first?
Get out of here.
And it's funny funny you say that because as someone who lives in D.C., it's interesting to hear the narratives about how H Street is working because the Shoe City can still be there. But the question of how long it stays. But I want to
better start selling Birkenstock.
But I do wanna, one of the things that I do think that is important to highlight is the way that these two forces that we're talking about, policing and gentrification, go hand in hand. Because one of the things that I think it's interesting to imagine that a lot of the CCTV cameras that are capturing all these stops and capturing what's happening the day Freddie was killed, you know, those cameras aren't just, you know, to keep people who are living in those neighborhoods safe. They're also projecting the possibility of what could happen to those neighborhoods when they become, you know, kind of higher income neighborhoods. So surveillance is also one of those ways that the police and policing can work hand in hand with private developers and other interests that are staking out parts of the city. And you see it, I mean, you are seeing it in Baltimore and the ways that local people, when they are high income, they also have a lot of influence on how much policing is going to happen at the outskirts of their neighborhood and within their neighborhood. And so there are many ways that the same strategies that people who are in communities that have been abused and historically ignored, a lot of those same strategies are being used by high income neighborhoods to keep people out as well. And so sometimes the tools that we see, you know, for good are the very same tools that can be manipulated to be exclusionary and to extend the force of the racist police state.
How many gonna ride for me? How many gonna die for me? How many gonna ride for me?
The burning corpse of a 9-year-old girl was found on a school playground in Davenport, Iowa, on September 17, 1990. Within days of the discovery of Jennifer Lewis's charred body, police arrested Stanley Liggins, an African-American man who had just been released from prison. An Iowa jury convicted him, and after 25 years behind bars, an appellate court has granted him a new trial. Does this sound like a story you'd like to hear more about? Well, you can, and I'll tell you how. Hi, it's Dennis from Undisclosed, and I want to talk to you about my favorite other than Undisclosed podcast on the air right now. It's called Suspect Convictions, and you can find it at www.suspectconvictions.com. Liggins, the defendant, will stand for retrial in May 2017. And once again, the question will be asked, who killed Jennifer Lewis? I've listened to all of the episodes to date, and Suspect Convictions is simply an incredible podcast. It's compelling, well-researched, and it presents the same deep dive into criminal justice issues that listeners of Undisclosed have come to care about. Perhaps most importantly, you've got to start listening to Suspect Convictions now before the retrial begins in May. That's what's unique about Suspect Convictions. During the trial, Suspect Convictions will be putting out very regular, possibly even daily episodes detailing the court proceedings, which will make for a fascinating, in-depth look at the process and conclusion. The other unique thing about Suspect Convictions is, as opposed to most true crime podcasts, listeners are guaranteed actual closure in the case. There will actually be an ending. You can learn more at suspectconvictions.com or wherever else you find your podcast. That's www.suspectconvictions.com.
It all wraps around the issue of representation, who gets to speak and who opinion actually matters. Even like, not to get too off topic, but this guy from Baltimore who went to New York with the mission of killing black people, right?
From Hamden.
So the news, you know, when they report on this guy, they call him, you know, I'm a guy who wants to go kill police, but they call him well-dressed army veteran. You know, stylish jacket army veteran. Like, they're already trying to make this person look like he's more than just a horrible, horrible person who had a horrible agenda, you know, and you kill a homeless guy that recycles. You know, this is like your first target. And then, you know, any and everything that the media is doing, that a lot of different media outlets is doing, is they're trying to humanize this guy as they, again, are like dehumanizing black people.
Yeah. I mean, something I actually want to, I kind of want to speak to you as well, because I know we mentioned earlier the CCTV cameras or whatever. And I think it's important because, you know, in Baltimore, you know, in terms of where we have those cameras, they aren't really in Hamden, you know, where he came from. They're in, like, you know, high crime, quote unquote, neighborhoods, black neighborhoods. And so I actually wanted to tell a story about that because, you know, I went 20, 2012, 2013 or something like that. I was a fellow for the mayor's office back when I was like a recent graduate of college. And so they took us to this building that's on Howard Street. I think it's like near Lexington Market. It's like on the corner.
Yeah.
And they took us to this building, and in the basement of the building, that's where they have the City Watch program. I'd never been there before. And it was like something out of like, you know, Blade Runner or something like that. It was insane. We sitting in the room, and there's like, you know, at least 20, 30 stations that have all these CCTV cameras, and they were like responding to crimes while we were there. And we were like, so what is, how much does this cost? They were like, well, it's cheap. It's like $5 million. And so that pays for all the staff, that pays for all the equipment, boom, boom. And so I sat there and watched a guy, this black dude who was like watching the cameras. And so he like zoomed in on someone who just bought drugs. And that moment he was like, City Watch to such and such unit. We have a man buying drugs on such and such street. They responded right there, arrested him right there, all on camera, like right there. I'm like, if you can do this right here with all this like nonviolent drug crimes, how come my man is able to plot a whole crime to go to New York and murder somebody, and you can't create preventative measures for people like that? Like, why are we monitoring black people for all these nonviolent things? Like, I don't really care if Pookie's buying drugs on the corner. We need to figure out how to create an environment in Baltimore that's better for black people. Why are we focusing on that?
If you can monitor a guy buying drugs on the corner, why can't you monitor the shipment?
Right, right, like, right.
You know, right. Message. But then it ties into the system benefits from throwing a bunch of people in jail. Mass incarceration is a big moneymaker. I don't think we talk about that enough. Mass incarceration is a big moneymaker. You know, it employs so many people in this country. You know, it controls the black population. It enhances the narrative, further dehumanizing black people. It makes sure we have, you know, plenty of people to build military supplies and things like that. You know, and then he gives touring activists something to talk about. Like, everybody wins. Like, everybody wins except for the people that have to go to jail. You know, we spoke about this before, and I know this guy's a big, big, big ally. Yo, it's Martin O'Malley.
Don't do that to me.
That was a joke. Martin O'Malley's not an ally. But how easy it was for a black person to go to jail under Martin O'Malley. And, you know, and his policy is, you know, partially connected to the reason why it was so easy for Freddie Gray to be arrested for nothing. That's the stink of Martin O'Malley.
Well, putting someone in jail is so much easier than all the things we need to do to make sure no one's going to jail in the first place. It's very satisfying and very easy as a politician and as a voter to think and say, we're going to get tough on crime, because there's a structure to it. There's metrics and there's numbers and there's ways to measure arrests and prosecutions and sentences. There's not really the same structure, at least in the measurable, easy way, for providing better opportunities for kids to go to school and do something after school that's fun and then, you know, have more in their lives. It's much harder to do, much harder to advocate for and then do. So that's, I mean, I think the structures of politics and policing, and it all lends itself to continue things as they are.
Yeah, that's kind of the bind that the current police department is in, because, you know, there's all this conversation back and forth around what policing should be. And to me, people make it like, again, it's like it's esoteric to most people. Like, how do we have better policing in Baltimore? How do we stop mass incarceration? But then also, how do we make sure that we have good public safety for residents? And it's like this back and forth. To me, let's like not make the police department racist. Like, can it not be racist? Because it's in a majority black city and it's affecting most black people. That's my problem, is that the complexity of the issues are definitely, you know, they're there. But there are certain fundamental elements. Like, if we already had the DOJ come in and say that there were all these patterns and practices of racial discrimination that, you know, systemically speaking, that the police department has arrested more black people or arresting black people at higher rates than white folks. If all these stats are there, then they're admitting the problem and being able to change the structural forces that make it what it is the answer. But I think that, like you said, it's easy to say we have more arrests, hence less crime, hence less murders. That's the most politically expedient way to, you know, get yourself into power in Baltimore. And I think that's why Stephanie did. She didn't run for a re-election. Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the ex-mayor, because I think the crime rate increased, the murder rate increased. And to most voters in Baltimore, that's what matters. You know, they want to feel safe in their homes and their nice neighborhoods, and particularly the white folks that vote. And so people like that right now, we're in a situation kind of like Martin O'Malley was in 1999. where he decided the most politically expedient way to get into power in the governor's office was to, you know, commission 757,000 illegal arrests from 1999 to 2005. And so I feel like now we're at that part again. The pendulum has kind of swung back and forth.
So the scariest thing is if Pew wants to be governor, people are going to start going to jail. Is that like the scariest thing to pay attention to right now?
right. And that's the thing. I don't, like Kevin Davis, the police commissioner, like he's a nice guy. Like I don't doubt that he's a nice person, but I don't care about that. It's like, are you going to change the structural forces of this police department? And some days I'm like, yeah. Other days I'm like, I don't know about you. And so I think it's ultimately, it is incumbent on the residents to build the power base necessary to actually make them respond to our needs, as opposed to wanting these people to just respond to us because of some kind of benign, you know, it's like benign neglect. Like, oh, maybe they just didn't know what happened. That's why they haven't changed the police department. It's like, no, these people are invested in maintaining their power and privilege while they're in office. So how do we get them to change, as opposed to waiting on them to change?
Kevin Davis is the only police officer I haven't had a real conversation with.
Like, mm-hmm.
I feel like Kevin Davis cares about these issues. I just feel like there's so many people that under him that don't care. Did you know Bats?
I knew him. I didn't know him.
I feel like I would be like, hey, Bats, I want to talk about policing. And he would respond with something like, affirmative, fuck you. Like, I don't feel like he would be like, you know, Kevin Davis is like, oh, let's get some Nando's and bring it up to my office. And, you know, I feel like Bats would be like, you know, I don't know.
Kevin Davis is cool. But as a person.
But being cool doesn't change a mentality.
Right,
so if the mentality of Joe knock you over the head riding up and down North Avenue,
you know,
he's probably never going to meet the commissioner.
Mm-hmm,
and if
mm-hmm.
he meets the commissioner, he's going to say, you know, I'm on the ground. I'm out here. I'm out here with these thugs, you know.
Mm-hmm,
I'm out here
mm-hmm.
with these thugs, you know. This is his mentality, and this is what his parents and his grandparents and his great-grandparents taught him, and he believes it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think, it's like, it doesn't really matter how nice they are. Like, it doesn't matter that Kevin Davis is a nice person. It's like, you are a police officer in Baltimore City. You're a white man in Baltimore leading our police department. There are certain things you're just not going to understand and certain things you're always going to propagate unless you're forced to change it.
You mean like George W. Bush seems like a nice person?
Right, like nowadays, like, no. I was
like,
tripping.
He paints and finger paints and...
And I was
good too. I think it's
we were all.
if I could just add one more thing to this conversation about, you know, nice people leading, I think you're absolutely right. You know, that's worth very little. But also, the idea of protocol and rules and technology, all of those things are also, you know, as valuable as someone wants to make them. And so, one of the things that I think it's important to highlight is, you know, in this particular case involving Freddie Gray, you know, there's protocols about how you're supposed to not throw someone into a van. And there are protocols about using a seatbelt. And there are protocols about taking people to the hospital. And there are all these cameras watching people constantly. But that is not enough. And I think that that's where you start to see the, like, good intentions can only go so far. You know, thoughtful leadership will only go so far. And, you know, rules will only go so far if policing is always in a context in which discretion is key and accountability is not even something that you can ask for. And so I think that part of what needs to happen as well is there needs to be real clarity on the part of citizens to get as much information to people to know the basis on which they make their claims against the police, right? So we know it was really terrible what happened, but our ability to enumerate all the ways that it's terrible and to fight on those on that basis is also part, I think, of a strategy to expose just how irresponsible these systems are.
Yeah, you'll get a good vibe from Lieutenant Russell. You know, you'll get a conversation, you'll get a good vibe from Kevin Davis, but then you got like all of these other police officers out there who are just like, I just feel like they're full of hate. And I don't know if you can penetrate that. I don't know if I, you know, before working on this podcast, I thought most police officers were horrible. Like, I thought they were horrible just based on my own experience. Not, you know, trying to bring in anybody else's experience. I can only speak for my own. Like, and I'm talking about simple stuff like me talking about a flat tire, like, you know, someone stabbing my tires and the cop trying to tell me that that didn't happen because I think he said something like his dad owned a tire place in Detroit. And I'm like, yo, what are you talking about, dog? Just do the report. Like, just do your job. So all of these different reasons, you know, I've only had bad experience with them. Like maybe like 90% of my experiences with police officers have been bad. So I don't know. But after working on this podcast, I feel like I have even I didn't know it was possible for me to feel worse. And I actually feel worse. So first I thought they were horrible. But now I think a lot of them are horrible. Or most of them are horrible and just heartless. Like I feel like they're heartless and stupid at the same time. Or the ones who aren't stupid are smart, which makes them even more evil because they know what they're doing. But either way, I don't see a win. Like I don't see a win.
I'm from the Andy Jones era, when homicides was high. Every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West I be getting money, but it's different on my side. Lord, 14 already trying to ride. Even when it goes,
I think it's especially heartbreaking when, you know, talking about protocols, when the written protocol is one thing, but the common practice is another. And a protocol is only as good as how well you enforce when it's broken. If you don't enforce it, or if you don't have a structure in place to make sure people are following it, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's written down.
I'm not a Republican, but I don't like how my tax dollars are being spent. I'm just not happy with this.
Right.
Like somebody get Fox News on the phone. Like, I'm not happy with this at all. Like I'm not happy with this at all.
Well, I mean, people should not underwrite their own oppression, right? Like the fact that the people of Baltimore are paying into a system that not only neglects their needs, but also abuses them is the fundamental place where I think you can get a lot of people on board, unfortunately. Because I think when you start to make this an issue of fiscal irresponsibility or mismanagement, you might be able to get more people to listen, unfortunately, because it seems like economic arguments go further than one about the human person and the dignity of Black people. And that's the unfortunate part of it. But I think the point that you make about, you know, your taxes shouldn't go to contribute to the harm of other people, this has been a really powerful argument that people have made. And if we could think about ways to revolutionize a system to hold back resources from the city and from the state, we might be onto something. Now, this is a heavy lift, but I think making those arguments is another way of getting to people to a consciousness about what's
like
happening.
My money's going to Nero, Porter, like Miller. What a joke. Like that's crazy. I'm also not happy with my public education since we on the topic. So I want to be refunded for that. I'm not happy with these police. The only people who are actually doing well are like the trash men in my neighborhood. These are the only guys that show up every week and they do what they're supposed to do.
Right,
like,
right.
They, you know, I put extra bags outside of the can. Like if I'm on a roll and stuff accumulates and I get back, and I'm like, oh my God, I got to throw all this stuff away. And I have like an extra bag. They get it. Mm-hmm. These are the only ones that do that job. Mm-hmm. Police officers and a lot of these teachers, I don't feel comfortable with my money going to them.
That speaks to Baltimore's political infrastructure because Baltimore is unique in the sense that, you know, we're one of the very few Black cities. We have like, you know, Black mayor, like until Kevin Davis took office as commissioner, we had a Black police commissioner, mostly Black city council, mostly Black representatives in the legislature in Annapolis. And for some reason, structural racism and white supremacy still is the rule of the day in Baltimore in terms of where resources are spent, in terms of how institutions operate. The question is, why is that the case?
Like, because all of the people in power want to be little oppressors.
Right.
They
right.
grow up and they dream at night and they say their prayers to whoever they pray to. And right. they say, oh, God, I just want to be a little oppressor when I grow up.
Right. 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 And it's the Black elites to me. Like people like Stephanie Mornings Blake. Like for years, I was just like, she is awful. Like she doesn't really care about poor and working class Black people in Baltimore. And like that was emblematic in everything she did, like from the Grand Prix nonsense that happened.
What was that?
I'm still
confused.
There were 2 years where it happened. I'm like, did I dream that? Like I lived downtown and I heard the wheels like yong yong, and I was like, this isn't real. Like there's a Grand Prix downtown. And so
Marsha, are you aware of this or no?
Yes, I am familiar with this Grand Prix thing, and I thought it was a joke when I heard about it. You bringing up all the topics to really get me started. Yeah. A friend of mine talked about having to like leave her home because like the sound of the cars. And I was like, wait, there's a Grand Prix in Baltimore. I mean, so this again is the ways that cities that are struggling financially, they come up with these ideas, right? And, you know, whether it's tax breaks for developers to do luxury housing or, you know, underwriting high-end retailers in communities where people can barely eat, they bring in these ideas. And you always want to take a step back and say, how many people did you talk to before you thought this was a good idea? but I think it's it's this idea that if you don't serve the population in your city, you start to serve a population that you hope comes to your city, and then you make sure that they're not fully, you know, engaged in community, and then you make sure that they don't have to pay their fair share. It's kind of an amazing way that we see throughout. And I think the more desperate the city is, the worse the ideas are.
This question is for Scott. Did the NAACP co-sponsor the Grand Prix?
I have no idea. I'll say about the Grand Prix. I thought the only thing I thought was amazing was when they had the stands and the lines up around the Inner Harbor, and I was coming home from work and I felt like I was driving on the racetrack. That was awesome. That was worth $100 million for me, or whatever it cost. No, I mean, yeah, that's governing by
as we take teachers out of schools, yeah, and bury them.
Exactly.
As our kids don't have technology, as police officers beat the shit out of people, mm-hmm, and harass on a daily basis, we have time to, yeah, do like a Grand Prix.
It's governing by gimmick, and it's something we've done for too long. And, you know, especially in Baltimore, where we've had a development strategy that's based on this or that magic bullet. This or that specific development or Grand Prix, oh, that's going to be the magic bullet. All of a sudden, we're going to have all sorts of new development and wonderful things. Mm. And instead of just focusing on having the city government, having our city actually be effective for everyone, that would be great if that was our mindset. That was the default expectation, not just the garbage men, but every aspect of city government worked for every person in Baltimore.
Okay, so while you're speaking to that, let's talk about what you would like to see moving forward and tell people how they can participate in what you have going on. And then we'll go to Adam, and then we'll go to Marsha to close this out. As Marsha's the smartest person in this conversation, so you gotta end it with a bang. You gotta end it with a bang. You gotta end it with
no
a bang.
No problem.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see people working across the city, across the neighborhood lines, across the district lines, working together and then listening too. And I think that's especially important. You know, I'm very conscious of every day when I go out there as a white guy from Canton working in East Baltimore that I need to make sure that what we're doing is responsible and it isn't just driving people out, but is actually working with people there. And so I think for us, I would certainly encourage everyone to come volunteer at the 6th Branch and help us building and help us work with the communities we work in. And I think number one is just listening across the city lines.
So in terms of LBS, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, like I mentioned before, we're a grassroots think tank that operates here in Baltimore, completely owned and controlled by black residents from here, created by us when we were college graduates of Towson University. And so one of the main focuses of our work is making sure that we change the necessary laws and policies that affect the quality of life of black people here in Baltimore and to transform our conditions in the long term. And one of the pillars of our work is the necessity of black institution building. So that way we can, instead of talking about these issues 10, 15 years from now about mass incarceration and education, we can have an ecosystem of black institutions that are building the necessary systems that are going to actually transform our conditions. And so if people want to get involved with LBS, they can go to our website at www.lbsbaltimore.com. They can also find us on all social media at LBS Baltimore.
Great. And Marsha?
Well, considering the number of cameras that are constantly watching communities in Baltimore and other cities, I would just encourage people to watch back. If someone's looking at you, you have the right to look back. And the way that we do that is we follow the money. We are very vigilant about the responses we get, and we appear. I think that we can never underestimate the power of people showing up and saying no. I think that's what happened in 2015. It happened in Ferguson in 2014, and it'll continue to happen because we are in a moment right now of great consciousness. And so every person who knows this story and knows other stories, I just ask you to share it with other people and make it very clear that, you know, half of struggle is showing up and being present. And the more we do that with each other, I think the more that we can see a difference.
Great, great. And I would encourage, you know, if you're a police officer, if you're a citizen, if you're a person out there listening and you feel like there's something that we don't see or that we're not getting, I encourage you to come into the studio or call in or, you know, be a part of the conversation, because we can't truly change anything or move forward unless we get perspective from all sides. We're pretty sure you can't prove us wrong, but give it a shot. You know, it could potentially work and it can open us all up. Where can we find you guys at?
We're at www.thesixthbranch.org. It's number 6, thbranch.org. And one more thing, we were really moved by talking with Mr. Perry. We had spoken through some veterans channels. We were referred to him and talked with him, and we're going to be doing a project and trying to help him maintain the garden.
Oh, so you're leaving East Baltimore to go to West Baltimore? Is it?
We are. This is a big deal. We drove there the other day. I was worried I'd turn into a pumpkin or something when I drove across the line.
Mr. Harrell's great. He deserves all the help and support he can get.
Yeah, so we'd love any help and volunteering and support for that, and really moved by the show and by him, and excited to work with him.
Sounds great. Adam?
Again, yeah, our website for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle is www.lbsbaltimore.com. Our office is located downtown near City Hall at 235 Holiday Street. You can also find us on all social media at LBS Baltimore. And me, myself, if you want to get in contact with me on social media, at Smart Black Man.
Look up LBS, donate, support, connect with them. You know, their reputation is impeccable. Everyone here knows. National people are still trying to catch up. Everybody locally knows. So, you know, this is definitely a group of amazing young people you should always support. And Marcia, where can we find you at?
If you really want to engage and not troll me, feel free to follow me on Twitter at Dr. M. Chatlin, DrMChatlain.
Thank you. And a reminder to fans to participate in social media discussion. You can discuss with the hashtag Undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda with the hashtag UDAddendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram with the handle at UndisclosedPOD. Thank you so much and have a great day. Let's keep the conversation going.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum along with super producer Meethal Telhan. A big thanks to our sponsor for this week's addendum, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. Hey, don't forget, Patrick is up for a Webby Award. Go to www.vote.webbyawards.com and search for Undisclosed to vote for Patrick's theme song. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who was kind enough to lend his sound to our show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 7. Until then.